This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. Today, we are talking about an amazing book, Flight of the Rondone by Patrick Girondi. I've been so eager to talk to Patrick because this book is very special. Hi, Patrick. Wow, this book is incredible. You are a brilliant writer.
Well, thank you for that.
You didn't graduate from high school, but today you are the CEO of a major company that handles gene therapy, and we're going to talk about how we got there. But I wanted to mention particularly when I was reading the book, I stopped at chapter 15, and you've left the hospital, and you're speeding away in your Fiat Duna, and you're driving along the Adriatic, and I thought, this chapter is so well written, any author in the world would be thrilled if they could write that well.
You know, that's very, very kind of you, obviously, to say that. Writing, for me, when my son was diagnosed with thalassemia, which is a rare blood disease, a fatal blood disease, when he was diagnosed, they said he wouldn't make it to be 14 years old, would have to transfuse constantly and live a very horrible life. And the only chance that he had was a bone marrow transplant. And when there was no donors in the bank and no one in our family that was compatible, writing really, I mean, in a lot of ways, writing and really saved me, actually. I mean, it just was incredible that I could, you know, put my thoughts to paper. And even not only my thoughts, but just things that could entertain my mind. And it really, really was a godsend for me, writing.
Well, it's beautiful writing, wonderful book in so many ways. We'll take a step back, and I mentioned that you didn't graduate from high school, but you had many accomplishments in your life because it led you to this place where your son becomes ill. But let's step back. When did you become a songwriter?
See, I grew up in the south side of Chicago, blue-collar neighborhood called Bridgeport by White Sox Park. Predominantly Italian. I grew up with predominantly Italians. And when my grandfather came to the United States in the 60s or the 50s, and he dreamt of singing lyric opera in the United States. That's what he did in Italy. He really never got too far with it, but I always had his love of music. And when I was a kid in school, I would sing the first Noel for the class. And I wrote my first song, I can remember it, called Drumbeat for my mother. I was about 8 or 9 years old. And then I was in a couple of garage bands as a kid. Then I ended up, going into the military and getting out of the military, going to work, and getting lucky enough to fall onto the Chicago Board of Trade, the Chicago Board Option Exchange. And, you know, I was on Oprah Winfrey Show as a guest twice, and American Most Eligible Bachelors with Sylvester Stallone and Magic Johnson. And then I got married, and my first son was diagnosed with thalassemia in 1990. I let the music go, and I just dedicated myself to finding a cure and to writing. We started our first company in 1993. In 1995, I was joined by John Walton, the son of Sam Walton of Walmart. He was my partner for 9 years. He stuck about $20 million into the company, and we developed therapies, cancer and non-cancer. In 2004, he handed the company over to me completely. He had a sickness in his family, which is the reason that he joined me, and they no longer had that worry, so he handed the company over to me. And unfortunately, John died in 2005. But we took over the gene therapy from Michelle Settlin, a brilliant French doctor who works at Memorial Sloan Kettering, in 2005. And the music started again. I think my first published CD was Orphan Soul in 2004, and it was how I found out who I was through the orphan diseases, of which thalassemia and sickle cell disease are both orphan diseases. I put sickle cell disease with thalassemia because they're both genetic defects on the beta globin gene, and if you cure one of them, you basically cure both diseases. So I was very dedicated to, me and all of my friends, I mean, they put in hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars in the end. I was dedicated to research, but then I stepped back and I entered the music again. And the first CD was Orphan Soul, How I Found My Soul Through the Orphan Diseases. The second one was Orphan's Journey, explaining a little bit what it was to navigate the waters of research and the hospitals. And then the third was in 2010, Orphan's Hope, when we actually thought that we had it taken care of, then Orphan's Cure in 2014, and then Orphan's Return, which it talks, there's songs in it like I'm the Doctor, Judge O, and it's all about, it's a lot of songs that have to do with the court case, because we eventually ended up in a huge court case, which was a front page in the New York Times in 2016. I could go on and on, but I'll...
Let's start with the day here your first son is born. Did you have any idea that you had a familial disease?
No idea. I mean, and what happens when we're in our mother's womb and up to a year and a half, we live on fetal hemoglobin, which is the gamma globin gene. And what happens around a year and a half, it transfers from the gamma globin gene, it shuts off, and the beta globin gene, which is the adult hemoglobin gene, turns on. And for our sickle cell patients and our thalassemic patients like my son, they have a defective beta globin gene. So it doesn't turn on properly. And the sickle cell patients, they have it actually added on top of that, is that their cells that they do produce sickle and clog their, you know, capillaries and veins, et cetera, creating horrible crises.
How soon after he was born did you
He was 2.5 years old.
2.5 years old.
In October of 1992.
How did it manifest itself? I mean, you thought he was healthy?
So, very healthy. Everything was fine. All of a sudden, he was lethargic. His face turned, his skin color turned to yellowish, sort of. And he was just very tired all the time. So we took him into the hospital and discovered that he had a hemoglobin of about 7.5. A normal hemoglobin for a male is anywhere between 11 and 16. A female could be, you know, 10 and 14. But he had a hemoglobin of 7.5, and he was diagnosed with beta thalassemia.
So that was pretty shocking.
Out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere. So you right there, you start with the doctors that you already have. You're trying to find out what can be done. And what did they at first say to you about what his prospects were?
Yeah, well, he was supposed to only make it till be about 14 years old and have to live a painful life with iron chelation and blood transfusions every 2 to 3 weeks. Instead, we didn't want to do that, obviously, because back in the early 90s, they still hadn't discovered the antibody for HIV and for hepatitis C. So, I mean, you were playing Russian roulette every time you got a blood transfusion. So I discovered a wonderful professor named Susan Perrine. She's now at the University of Boston. Back then, she was at Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute. And she was working with a drug called arginine butyrate, which, if given to the patients, it stimulated the fetal hemoglobin to work again. And so for about 7 years, my son actually was on this arginine butyrate, which was very safe. The problem was, though, he had to be hooked up to a pump about 12 to 16 hours a day, and it carried his hemoglobin back to about 10 so that he could live a somewhat normal life.
But that wasn't good enough for you. You decided to look further into it. How did you start your research? Since you didn't go to college, you didn't have a science or a math background, how did you decide to pick up the medical books and plow into them?
Yeah, I mean, When the doctors tell you that, you know, this is the way it is, your kid's going to die before he's 14, it doesn't leave you a lot of room. And so you ask yourself, okay, what am I going to do here? And the answer came back to me, well, I'm going to have to try to cure the disease. Now, obviously, I'm not a researcher, and I'm not a scientist, and I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But what I started doing was accumulating knowledge about the disease And back then, I had, you know, all of my friends sending me miles and miles of faxes so that I could stay up to date on every single Lancet, every single New England Journal and Science, whatever it was that came up with an article about the disease. And I just, you know, plowed ahead. From making arginine butyrate, we ended up in 2000 discovering Michelle Sedelin, who had published in Nature magazine that he cured six generations of thalassemic mice with gene therapy using the disarmed HIV vector loaded with the beta globin gene. And I knew it. Once I read that article and I saw his data, I made an appointment to meet with him in Rome. I met with him. I looked in his eyes and I said, this is it. This is my guy. And in 2003, he told me that Sloan Kettering was abandoning the project because they're a cancer center, basically. And so I looked around to try to find a company to take over the research. But, you know, I talked to all the major players, but they're all like, well, you're a nice guy and you're a good father, but, you know, gene therapy is science fiction, you know, it ain't going to work. And so I didn't have a choice. So in 2005, I bought the product from Memorial Sloan Kettering. And between 2005 and 2010, Michelle Sedelin, his wife Isabel Rivera, who's a brilliant scientist as well, Christopher Ballas, one of our scientists, and Paolo Moy, Aurelio Maggio, a bunch of different doctors that we got together, John Tisdale of the NIH, they worked and we came up with the best product till then. We delivered in August and September of 2010 the first world's batch of gene therapy, because up until then it cost $1 million a person to make, and you could only make it one person at a time. Instead, we made a batch of 10 for $1.3 million or $130,000 per patient.
Wow.
And I don't deserve any of the credit, Patsy. I mean, I believe me, I don't. I mean, I'm a father who just did what I needed to do to help my son. I was lucky that I lived the American dream. I had been successful at the exchanges, so I had some money. And had I been a truck driver, had I been a nurse, had I been, you know, a number of many other things, my life would have been very different. But I was lucky. I had the means to push it forward, push the research forward. But again, I'm no different, no better than anyone else. And I certainly have met over the years dozens and dozens of parents who are really incredible in comparison to me. But and so I was very lucky. We delivered that medicine. And in 2011, we returned the product to Memorial Sloan Kettering, and we decided that they would go forward with it. In 2015, I wasn't happy with the progress being made, and I went to court in New York, federal court, Judge Nathan, and I asked her, can you please force Memorial Sloan Kettering to return the project to me because it's slowing down, and we have a competitor who I believe has a worse product or a not a great product, and you know we're losing time. And she wouldn't force them to return it to us, but she said that I could file other charges. So we did, and in 2020 basically the project was returned to us. Unfortunately, we discovered, as you'll read in the book, I don't want to read the ruin the book.
I know. There's what comes through this book is really how often you have, I mean, you speak very honestly about dealing with doctors and dealing with drug companies and the problems, and sometimes their own personalities of these people get in the way of the work that needs to be done.
Yeah, and I mean, the problem in, you know, we grew up with, you know, Dr. Welby and stuff like that. And the problem, particularly with the United States, by the way, it's exasperated by, you know, our idea of capitalism or whatever. But, you know, when we were children, healthcare was a service. And doctors didn't make, you know, $100 million and aspirins didn't cost $27 a piece in the emergency room. You know, it was actually a service. And it was, you know, we had back in the 80s, we had 34% of all of our employees in the United States were in unions. And so all of the people had insurance, and the other 66% that weren't in unions gave their people insurance anyway because they didn't want to have unions. And it was very affordable. It was kind of like it is in Europe today and in most parts of the world. But slowly but surely, health became an industry. And in the United States, it's probably the biggest industry of any of them. I mean, 20% of our national GDP goes to healthcare, and that's not even adding all of the trillions, probably at least hundreds of billions of dollars that people are spending every month on healthcare. I mean, I have friends that spend $4,000 a month for their insurance, and so it's turned into an industry. And just like any other industry, whether it's the Las Vegas, the casinos in Las Vegas, or it's Ford or General Motors or IBM or Google, it's a company, and it's all about for profit. And a lot of the times, we have these not-for-profits, which is even worse, where you'll see, for example, Memorial Sloan Kettering is a not-for-profit, but the CEO, makes between $6.5 and $7 million a year. And then when a child gets cancer, they help them set up a GoFundMe page. I mean, it's all kind of become crazy, and I'm sure that, somehow it's going to get fixed because it needs to be fixed.
Well, one of the things I think, if people read this book, it will open their eyes, because having been myself involved in, I was a hematologist tech, so I really understand this. In the lab, I did, find people with sickle cell anemia. What I think is important about this book, in addition to being just a great read, because you write in such a way that it's an exciting story and very revealing and very honest, but really people should open their eyes to these things. And I think maybe now that the pandemic, and we see that there's a lot of people taking a lot of profits, and we don't always know if they're doing the right thing. You are to be admired and to be honored, because I think this book is fantastic. I don't know if you're going to write another book, but you are a born storyteller.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, thank you so much. And there's actually another 4 books already written, and I'm trying to negotiate with the Skyhorse now about them. And I can tell you another thing, that the people that buy the book, they can rest assured that the money that they pay for the book, at least anything that would go to me, is going to be going to research. You know, in the United States, when I'm here, I have a 2009 Sebring, and in Italy, I have a 1996 Fiat Punto.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in the end, for me, my life is about the research. Anything that I write, any of my music, anything I do, it's all about San Rocco Therapeutics.
This is an amazing story. And, sometimes it was meant to be. Coming out at this time when people are aware of what happened during the pandemic and the confusion and the scientists not getting along and scientists not giving us straight answers, having opportunity to read your book will be very helpful, I think, to put things in perspective. And as you said, you put your money into the research. And that's where it's supposed to go. And when we donate money to these nonprofits, we have to be, I think, much firmer. And also, when our government gives grants, much firmer about where the money's going and why.
Yes, that is right. And that is one of the biggest sins that I've noticed and that I've uncovered. And then, first of all, St. Jude, by the way, I love it. I love them, Scott Elmer, the whole crew over there, wonderful people. No Kid pays a nickel, and they're a very, very, just an incredible organization. And I just wanted to bring that out, that there are some great organizations out there. But you're 100% right, because what the taxpayers don't realize is that 90%, 80% of all the research in the United States is paid for by the taxpayers. And the small organizations, for example, the Sickle Cell Anemia Foundation of Kentucky or of Florida or of what. These are the people that are putting the dollars into the research. And then the research institutes are taking them, giving them, because of the executives all being in cahoots together, so the executives of these research centers, whether they be for-profit or not-for-profit, are then making deals with the executives of Merck and Pfizer and all of the other ones, and they're selling for pennies on the dollar all of the research, all of these inventions, and then they make the patient, who is also the taxpayer, pay out of the nose when he needs these. I mean, it's just a ripoff.
It is. You have really written about it. I think that it's come at the right time. People need to wake up. It's sort of like what happened with the colleges. Nobody paid attention. The presidents of the colleges, the presidents of state universities, they make millions and millions and millions of dollars. And yet...
Right, and they haven't given the professors and the teachers a pay raise in 30 years.
Well, it depends. If the tenured professors sometimes get so much money, for teaching one class a week, it's ridiculous, and we're paying for it.
Out anymore.
What?
Yeah, it's crazy.
It is crazy.
Yeah, but now they rarely give tenures out any longer.
Good.
I mean, it's so hard today, and so if you're exactly right. All of that money has gone up to the executives who are running these Harvard and Yale and wherever it is. And, you know, we've watched the average tuition in the United States, I think it's $36,000 now. It's crazy.
It is. This is sort of a wake-up call. This book is wonderful. It's called Flight of the Rondone. Explain what that is.
Okay. Yes. So when my son was diagnosed and he started doing the experimental medicine that I talked about earlier in your show, he would have had to have been hospitalized in the United States to do it, and it would cost about $70,000. For 40 days. So I couldn't do that. It made no sense. I need the money for research, not for that. So I ended up moving to Italy and opened up a medical center about 20 miles from my grandfather's town. And in our town, which is called Altamura, every year in like March, end of March, beginning of April, the Rondone, they arrive. And the Rondone is the Swift. So in English, that's what it would be, the Swift. And so they arrive, they fly up to 140 miles an hour coming from Africa, and they lay their eggs and hatch their young in our town, Altamura. The interesting thing about a Rondone is that it always has to land at least 15, 20 feet in the air because they have short bodies and very long wings. So if they land on the ground, they can't take off again because they try to flap the wings, but they hit the ground. So the people in my town, we all know what we need to do, and we've done it many times when my children were kids, that you find the bird that can't, that's stranded on the ground before he gets eaten by a cat or run over by a car, and you cup him in your hands, and you just throw him as high as you can, trying to get him a couple stories up if possible, so that he has all the time to begin flapping his wings and live. Well, that's exactly what happened to me when I was 16 years old, and I was in front of Clarence Bryan, a wonderful man, a judge, and he said, Patrick, you've been in front of me too many times. Bring me your enlistment papers next time. And I ended up having to go to the Air Force because they were the only one that had a delayed enlistment. And I was working, in a hospital kitchen. I had Big Mama who protected me. I mean, goes on and on.
It's a wonderful...
So many people.
It's a wonderful, wonderful book. It's called Flight of the Rondone, High School Dropout versus Big Pharma, The Fight to Save My Son's Life, and it's by Patrick Girondi. Do you have a website you want people to go to?
Yeah, it's patgirondi.com.
Okay. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Pat. This is an amazing book. I'm going to really work hard to promote this book. And I'm glad that you mentioned St. Jude, because I always mention St. Jude and ask all of my listeners to send books for children to the hospital. I think you're an amazing human being. I look forward to you coming back as soon as you either have another book coming out or perhaps to announce that they're picking this up for a streaming video.
Thank you very much, Bethy. I appreciate it very much. God bless you.
God bless you. You've done amazing work. Thank you very much. Bye-bye now. Flight of the Rondone by Patrick Girondi is a fantastic book. Bye now.